You're listening to the My SBA Loan Pro Podcast, hosted by Ryan Smith, principal broker and founder of Think SBA, a one-of-a-kind loan brokerage serving small business owners and entrepreneurs in their quest to purchase real estate, acquire a business or franchise, or obtain working capital. In each episode, Ryan reveals valuable insights and best practices regarding the SBA loan program and application process. Let's get started.
Hey everyone, this is Ryan Smith, principal and founder of Think SBA, and I'd like to welcome you to the first episode of the My SBA Loan Pro podcast, Face to Face. We have with us today someone who has been illustrious on X, formerly known as Twitter, with his posts and what he has done for many searchers on the platform. His name is Elliot Holland, and he's with Guardian Due Diligence. Elliot, welcome to the podcast.
I'm so honored to be here, especially on the first episode, and I can't wait to have a good time and hopefully add some value to your listeners.
Well, I know you definitely will. And as you know, I represent individuals who are buying businesses, and the topic of quality of earnings reports comes up quite frequently, and I'm looking forward to you sharing in-depth information for them so that they can make the best decision for their particular acquisition.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, give us a little background on you, how you got started, and why you have such a passion for SMB.
Sure. I'm a reformed engineer. Did some strategy consulting right after undergrad. Won the business school lottery and got into Harvard Business School. And that's when I realized how dumb I was, all the Wall Street people and private equity folks that were already there. But I wanted a piece of the pie. So I just called 250 people. I landed one job in Boston at a private equity firm that was actually a family office that was operating as a private equity firm. And very quickly, I recognized that my boss at that firm was making way more money than some of my friends' bosses at their Wall Street shop and had way more autonomy. He worked with his friends. His daughter worked with him. She's now taking over the outfit. And so my concept of private equity changed. I then convinced another mentor to work with me as an independent sponsor, just an independent business buyer, typically with some private equity or investment banking experience. I did that for several years. We bought three companies into that entity. My business partner effectively retired, and I went out as a self-funded searcher. And long story short, I failed. I had a couple of deals I took a run at. One, I overextended myself, and into 2016, it kind of blew up. And I took 2017 off, and I was like, I have all these unique private equity skills, business growth skills. What do I do with this? And I said, hey, look, there's a lot of new people coming into the searcher arena. Many of them have never negotiated anything more than a 10% increase on an offer letter, never like operated in free space, never raised capital, never talked to brokers. And they're going to come in here and they're going to get bamboozled if they don't have help.
They're going to get crushed, right?
Yeah. I started Guardian to help them not get crushed, to help people have a place where they could trust the due diligence process through what we were doing, and to, over time, expand to more advisory services. So that's story about me and kind of how I started. And what we're doing now is sort of taking our business from just the quality of earnings stuff, which I'll talk to you about in a minute, and moving into sort of every piece of advisory somebody would need to get a deal done.
That's great. You know, like you mentioned, there are a lot of individuals in the ETA space who don't have the background that you do. And therefore, when they go up against a listing broker, a seller, they're really at a disadvantage. And if they haven't developed those skills necessary, like you said, to go toe to toe, they're going to get crushed. They're going to get bamboozled. And unfortunately, they might close the deal, but it also might be a bad deal for them while the seller and the listing broker get paid and move on. But that's where you come in. Tell us about your passion for SMB, because is what I've seen is that individuals who serve SMB individuals, they have a passion for it. It's not just about collecting a commission check, but it's about providing, like you said, right, a valuable service to these individuals to make sure that when they close that loan and when they buy that business, it was actually a good deal for them.
Yeah, so I bet on SMB before there was an ETA class at Harvard Business School.
Wow.
That's right. And I bet because I didn't come up rich. And so people at business school were saying, oh man, there's no use for deals under $2 million of EBITDA. You can't finance them. They're a waste of time. And I was like, hold on. $800,000 of EBITDA sounds like a whole lot for me.
Sounds
I could do
good.
A whole lot. Yeah, I could do some things with $800,000 of EBITDA. And now they started using the SBA 7A program as an acquisition tool, which before it was not an acquisition tool. Mm-hmm. And so I've been in this about 15 years now, and I never lost the vigor or the passion for the industry. The industry has moved far forward. I've been long on this forever. And so my passion comes from the fact that I think the SBA 7A program and business acquisition is the quickest, most surefire way to create million-dollar wealth for everyday people. Mm-hmm. So I might have a fancy degree. Most of my clients don't. You know, mm-hmm. I may have been doing this for a while. Most of my clients have been in it 3 to 6 months. And so when you think about being able to deliver 15 years of experience that predates a lot of the material that's in the ecosystem mm-hmm. and deliver that help to somebody who just read Buy Then Build or just read the HBR Guide to Buying a Small Business like last week, it's amazing. And then I'll say one more thing. I do very intense, both financial but also psychological work because a lot of this stuff is just human interaction. And every one of my clients is willing to go through an SBA program, put up a $1 million personal guarantee to give them and their family a chance to kind of leapfrog into a very different tax bracket, right? Mm-hmm. Those people should be respected hard stop. And so I work with some of the coolest, most creative, most risk neutral folks. And so it's like, you know, I have a lot of fun every day of what I do.
That's awesome, though. Like you mentioned, there's so much risk involved in buying a business. And if they are obtaining an SBA loan, they're going to personally guarantee that.
That's right.
And obviously, that comes with a lot of responsibility. And the reason you do what you do is because you need these individuals to know exactly what they're getting into. And one of the things that I see, and I'm sure you see this a lot, is there are individuals who are buying businesses and they look at a quality of earnings report price tag and mm-hmm. they think, oh, maybe I can do this on my own. But just as you said, right, they're most of them, not all, but most of them are rookies, they're novices.
Right.
You and I have seen hundreds, if not thousands, of profit and loss statements and balance sheets. And business acquisition is so much different than real estate because real estate's yes. pretty simple. You know, P&Ls are pretty simple. But
that's
when
right.
you're looking at a small business, almost every business owner has different classifications of expenses, income, and even worse, which is where you come in, and you posted about this yesterday.
Yes.
They're purposely hiding or inflating numbers to sell their business for more money, but then leave the business buyer with bad goods. That's where you come in, right?
That's right. And just like the used car lot, you can't take it back. But this is a $1 million clunker, a $1 million limit. And so I just be direct. There's no way that somebody that's been looking at deals for 6 months, 12 months mm-hmm. is prepared to do this on their own. And let me just go through a couple of the reasons why. Because if you're just not going to do a QOE, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to somebody who actually is listening to Wise Counsel.
Exactly.
So let me just tell you, a 60-year-old business broker that's been doing this for 30 years will run circles around you. I don't mm-hmm. care if you worked for Warren Buffett and then Steve Schwarzman. When you get into the swamp with these small deals, that 60-year-old broker will run circles around you. That seller that you call unsophisticated has put kids through college, paid mortgages, employed people. He will run circles around you. So now they're in cahoots, right?
That's right.
So now they're running figure eights around you. Now, people like Ryan, who have been in the SBA lending game for a long time, know about things to look at in these deals that you don't know. Mm-hmm. And so when you go to Ryan and say, hey, here's this deal, and it's like this and it's like that, and you've obviously missed some key things that he knows will put you in a very bad position, now you're talking to the person who's going to fund a large portion of your deal, and you look silly there. So that's the third time. And then what you don't realize is, although some of the people in this ecosystem have CPA behind their name, have controller behind their name, a lot of these folks are not pressed to their limits around the quality of their work. And so you want to trust them because they have these, you know, letters behind their name, but you can't trust them at all. And the final thing I'll say, sellers have this huge incentive to lie that people forget about. And so even reasonable people are going to be tempted to lie. And here's why. For every dollar of cash flow they can convince you is there, or EBITDA they convince you is there, that's not really there. They don't get paid dollar for dollar, Ryan. They're getting paid 3 to 5 times that.
Right.
There's a lot of people that will lie in that scenario. And so protect yourself, because a $25,000 QOE, right, can save you $1 million. That's a 40x ROI. And I had a prospect last year who decided to go it alone, and she lost her business. And that's $1 million personal guarantee she's going to have to pay back. And I'm sure she's not thinking about the $25,000 that would have been hard to spend a year ago. So this is real stuff.
And you bring up a good point. So one of the dynamics in business acquisition is that searchers, most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time, they're interacting with a listing broker. And again, most of the time, I would say overwhelmingly most of the time, the listing broker says, I'm going to represent the seller. And ding, 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 I'm going to represent you too.
That's right.
And I can do that really well. Believe me.
Yes. And I'm the person to represent you, buyer. You can trust me.
Now, you and I know, because we're in this every day, they're really representing the seller. And they're telling the buyer that, so that they can get both sides of the commission.
Yes.
But like you said earlier, the seller and the listing broker, they're on the same team. They're the tag team. The listing broker's really not on the side of the buyer. And so as a buyer, what they need to do through representation is they need to level up so that they know, again, that they're buying a business that they think they're buying, not buying a business that when they actually get the keys, is a lemon.
Right.
We don't want that. I don't want that. You don't want that. The difficulty is that I deal with individuals who sometimes have a small view, meaning they're pinching pennies instead of looking at what they might lose. So for example, I might work with someone who's buying $1 million business and they look at a quality of earnings report price tag and they think, you know what, I can DIY this. And I'm saying to them, I don't think you can DIY it. I can get you, like you said, right? I can get you to, meaning me, I can get you to a certain point.
Sure.
But hey, I'm not a CPA. I never went to Harvard. There's no way that I can identify all of the possible misgivings or shortfalls within those financial statements, but you can. So would you tell the audience when they should engage you? What size of a loan based on their risk tolerance, their experience, again, the purchase price, those types of things. Give the audience a real clear understanding of when they should engage you. And if they don't engage you, what they're actually putting on the table that could come back to haunt them later, when they have that personal guarantee hanging over their head?
So great question. And I'm going to define a quality of earnings and then get into the deal size and then the downside risk of not doing it. So think of a quality of earnings as a mini audit specifically for business buyers ahead of an acquisition. Small business financials are not audited. So when you invest in Apple and Coke and Pepsi, they have audited financials. So they have one big four company doing their financials and another one auditing them. So you have some confidence in their financials. Joe's machine shop down the street, no standards.
Come on. Come on.
None.
What?
None. Zero. Nobody has any authority to check those financials. Taxes. People minimize their profit on them to minimize their payments to Uncle Sam. QuickBooks, if you think QuickBooks is solid without any validation, I have a business to sell you as well. Because
That's right.
QuickBooks is so easy to manipulate, it's crazy. And most people don't understand bank statements. So the quality of earnings puts complex, messy financials together for a buyer in 3 to 5 weeks so that they can fit it inside of their 90-day, 120-day process to buy the business so that they don't go into messy financials, new business they don't know that well, probably like entrepreneurship that they're not all that experienced with, and a set of financials that are not solid. So what size deal? My statement, and I've said this for a long time, I don't know anybody that can lose $1 million.
I certainly can't.
And you know, and my rich friends who probably could don't want to lose.
They don't want to. No, I mean, $1 million is $1 million. Hey, you know, Mr. Wonderful on Shark Tank.
Yes.
He said, hey, $10,000 is $10,000.
That's right.
They don't want to lose
that. Right.
So how can somebody who maybe has $200,000 going into a deal want to risk losing $1 million?
And so that is the downside. So what you're saying is that, hey, I know that losing a deal on $1 million personal guarantee is catastrophic. You're not going to just go home and cry and be upset and depressed. Your family might leave you, right?
Yep.
You may spend 5 or 10 years digging out of that. You may have to file for bankruptcy. You may have to go work a job to pay that $1 million off so you don't have to file for bankruptcy, right? To try to keep your assets. And so you're saying that, hey, I see this catastrophic risk, Elliot, but I'm just going to go bet this $1 million with no protection on messy financials. And so what you get is you get this exuberance of, I did it myself, DIY. And I've seen people lambast on LinkedIn about how they did their quality of earnings themselves. And they'll even put bad accounting math on LinkedIn showing what they did that was a mistake, not recognizing that it was wrong. And then a year later, they lost their business. They don't know what happened. Wait, EBITDA's not cash flow? Hold on, wait, the accounts receivable weren't accurate? Hold on, a system was hidden from me? This is like the big boy league. You can't walk into this naive. And so that's the risk. And so on any deal over $1 million, any deal where the purchase price is more than you can lose, at the point of a letter of intent, you need to get started with the quality of earnings within 1 week. Now, I do quality of earnings, other people do them. Find somebody who can do them. But $1 million is too much to bet. And so real estate values don't fluctuate that much. We're talking about cash flow businesses. So like $1 million cash flow business or EBITDA business could be a $500,000 or $250,000 or $0 EBITDA business in 6 months. And so if you even just say the multiple is the same, 4 times $1 million, 4 million, 4 times 250,000 is only 1 million, 1/4. And so when you're dealing with a complex business where cash flow can be very volatile, you're just in over your head. Get some help.
Explain the difference. You touched on this earlier. Explain to my audience the difference between profit and loss statement and the tax return. And the strategies, there's a strategy with each of them. If you could explain that, that would be really helpful.
Sure. So first off, every SBA lender is going to say that they write to the tax return. So people get comfortable with the tax returns right away until they see them, Ryan. Right? Because they got this shiny confidential information memorandum that said $5 million in revenue, $1 million in seller's discretionary earnings. And now they see the tax return, and it's about $5 million in revenue, but it's $200 in net income. Well, hold on, man. What happened?
That's right.
Private business owners, through the tax code in the United States, A, have a lot of ways they can shield earnings. So if they don't have to pay taxes, the tax code is written for small business owners. On top of that, small business owners take some leisure with personal expenses that they run through their tax return so they can minimize what they pay Uncle Sam. And when you've seen hundreds and thousands, we know that that number at the bottom of the tax return is just the start.
That's right.
Then let's talk about the financials. So the financials, I'm going to talk about the financials in the broker's packet, which is often called a confidential information memorandum. So what they're going to do is take what's out of QuickBooks, so call that $5 million and maybe $250,000 of net income. And then they're going to start saying, hey, those tickets to the Dallas Mavericks, that's a personal expense. That trip to Europe, that's a personal expense. Those trucks, that's a personal expense. The sister doesn't really work in the business. And so as you start adding those things back, and that's what we call them, all of a sudden you get to $1 million of EBITDA or cash flow. And so what ends up happening, and Ryan knows this better than me, but what the bank is trying to reconcile is this $200 of net income on the taxes and this $1 million of seller's discretionary earnings on an adjusted basis in the confidential information memorandum and what's believable.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
And reconciling those two things is a huge piece of what the quality of earnings does, a huge piece of the SBA underwriting that Ryan does, and something that I'm talking about because I've seen it so many times. As a first-time buyer, you're not going to know squat.
Nope. I remember as a young lender looking at profit and loss statements, I always use this reference. It looked like looking at the ocean, huge. What are these? What am I even looking at? Now when I look at it, I know exactly where to go. It's like looking at a jacuzzi, right? I know exactly where to go. And even though there are controls, supposedly, or their bookkeeper or their CPA should have controls over the profit and loss statements, unfortunately, like you had said, they're almost discretionary, meaning they can almost produce whatever they want, because they can leave some things in that shouldn't be there. They can take some things out that should be there. So that's right. That's why the SBA says, hey, we're not going to rely on those.
That's right.
Because we're going to rely on the tax returns, which you're federally attesting are accurate.
Yes.
But we also know that there's the game that's played to reduce their tax burden. That's and right. So thank you for explaining that. I wanted my audience to understand the risks they're taking if they take the tax returns at face value and if they take the profit and loss statements at face value, especially if they're new to entrepreneurship through acquisition. Now, the best way that I learn and a lot of people learn is through hearing stories. Share with us a couple of case studies where you have come in. You have the S on your chest, you're wearing that cape, and you save the day.
Sure. So our approach to quality of earnings is a deal person's approach. And so I'm going to tell some stories that have the pure accounting piece, but a little bit of common sense deal knowledge too. So one of my clients was buying an online technology business, not software, but online technology enabled services. And it was a serial entrepreneur that had started three different companies and was kind of tired of this one. It was going to go on to the fourth. And so he puts together the confidential information memorandum, the broker does. And my client, the buyer, was so happy because the management team that the seller had created was going to stay in the business. So this person's thinking passive income. I'm going to Barbados. I got these people already in place. I'm winning, Elliot. And then we started looking, and the management team was comprised of five people that had been doing like online tech enabled stuff for like 15 years. But when I look, they're all marking their salaries at $60,000. You could not replace those people for $60,000.
No, such a good point.
You'd probably have to replace them at $160,000. Furthermore, if these people had moved with this entrepreneur for three companies and probably had a little bit of equity or bonuses in all those former entities, do you really think they're going to work for you, passive buyer, as a pure employee? Or are they going to go with the seller on his new thing as soon as the dust settles? And so what I had to convince my client was what's stated on paper and qualitatively attested to, as you said, right, is complete hogwash. That's as right. soon as you buy this business, they're going to say, hey, I need $100K more, or I'm going to totally torpedo this thing. Yep. And then once you pay them that, they're going to stay about 6 months to get it and then go follow their former owner.
That's right. So it was real in that, let's say maybe they were making 60.
Right.
But that's post-transfer. I mean, I'm sorry, that's pre-transfer. That's pre-transfer. But then after pre-transfer, now that's when reality sets in. And so,
exactly.
And so they weren't necessarily lying, but they were keeping something back that would change dramatically post-transfer, because there's a little quid pro quo there going on.
Right.
That we don't know where that trail ends presently.
Exactly.
But that's going to change quickly post-transition.
Yes. And sometimes when things are too good to be true, they are. Because if you didn't, and we just looked at that $60,000 and just said, are they really going to work for that? So that's not pure accounting. Mm-hmm. That's sort of common sense deal stuff. And so that's where we bring some help. I'll tell another story. There was a group of folks buying a landscaping company. And people always tell me, oh, Elliot, it's a simple business. QOE light. I trust the seller. I love here. I should tape it so I can play it back to folks after the quality of earnings. So we're going through the process. And if you know profit and loss statements, and if you know balance sheets for certain industries, you know not only what is misstated, but what should be there that isn't. So I'm going through the process and I'm like, hey, client, this company lays sod, plants trees, lays mulch, all this kind of stuff, and they don't have any inventory. Oh, no, Elliot, they don't like leaving cash around. They buy everything, you know, like cash on delivery. I've been to their warehouse. There's nothing in it. And I'm like, oh, they have inventory. Oh, no, they just don't do it that way. You just got to, we've seen them. Don't worry. I said, okay. So I go through my quality of earnings process because I'm not going to argue with my clients. That's not my position. Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, we finished the quality of earnings. A month later, they start sending me stuff. So we help with the working capital analysis. Mm-hmm. And as part of that is the inventory number. Mm-hmm. So lo and behold, a month later, I get a schedule. Elliot, does this look right? Oh, $150,000 of inventory.
Wow. There.
And so what ended up happening is we were able to preview the client for that. So when they saw it, it wasn't a surprise. Mm-hmm. They were actually able to get the seller to finance the inventory because he hadn't divulged it earlier. And so it ended up being a win for the client. But this is the kind of stuff that you see in smaller businesses that could get you messed up. For instance, what could have happened had you not known inventory was there, the seller sells all of his inventory the day he closes. Mm-hmm. And leaves you with the business that had $150,000 of inventory previously, but he sold it all at close, and you have to now replenish it with the working capital line that wasn't large enough to account for that $150,000 of inventory you're going to need to buy.
Hmm. Yeah,
that's what we kept from happening to our clients.
Yeah, what I hear you saying is something that happens quite frequently, and I don't really understand the dynamic, but here's someone like you who's been doing this for a long time. Obviously, you're Ivy League educated. You know what you're doing. You're there to serve them, right? You're on their team. Right. But they're actually trying to sell you on the deal about things they don't know about. Elliot, that stuff happens all the time.
All the time.
And what we know is that they're emotionally involved. They've already put their arms around the business. They're hugging it like a tree. They don't want to let go. But what they need to understand is that this is a business. There's a lot of moving parts. Don't get emotionally involved, and don't try to sell your service providers who are there to identify risks on a business that you really don't know.
And here's where the psychology of what I do comes into play, and another reason why I love it so much, because it has these layers, mm-hmm. right? So 80% of my clients don't like it when the report comes back showing anything different than the confidential information memorandum, even though they paid me to check that exact thing.
That's interesting.
Here's the psychology of it, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And this is the hazard that people were walking into that I started this to protect you from. When you're making six figures, 100 grand, 150 grand, mm-hmm. a lot of my clients are plus or minus $50,000 in that realm. And you're going and chasing a $3 million acquisition, right? Mm-hmm. So you're talking about like 30xing mm-hmm. your earning potential, right? So this is like the country club, the private jet, you know, hanging out at the rooftop, you know, next to Central Park. And this is like your reasonable current life, which isn't bad, but this is 30 times better.
You're right.
You should not trust yourself on the first time on a 30x up move when you don't know accounting, you don't know legal, you just shouldn't. Like, nobody does. The other thing that happens is that people have limited budgets. So, hey, I've got $100,000. I've got to do equity for the deal and service, quality of earnings and legal. So I don't have money for all that. So I'm going to skimp on it and just close my eyes and hope. Or a lot of corporate negotiations, Ryan, there's some stamp behind the person speaking that the company's going to actually backstop. So if you're talking to Home Depot, you're talking to Schlumberger, and if they tell a big fib, the company, if a person there tells a big fib, the company is going to kind of backstop it because it has a reputation to withhold. With these smaller sellers, there's no backstop. If they get over on you, that's it. And so the first-time buyer wants to believe the seller, has never had to stand up to somebody that could be twice their age and say, no, I don't believe you. I think that's a lie. They're probably going to 30x their earnings potential. And they had the boldness to try something that I think is smart, but they haven't developed the risk knowledge to know what they're getting into. And so I think those things drive that phenomenon. And so it happens on 80% of my client engagements. Wow. And I just bake it into the process because I don't get upset. I don't think it's silly. It's like I know what's happening.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, they're hiring you to mitigate their risk. And then when you reveal, you pull back the curtain and you reveal, hey, here's your risk. They're upset with you. I want to ask you if you see this also. As I shared with you earlier, I work with individuals who are very new to the ETA space. They have maybe $100,000, $200,000 saved up. They're hard workers, but by and large, they're blue-collar workers. They don't come from money. Then on the other side, I work with the Ivy League graduates, private equity trained. And Elliot, here's what I see. Tell me if you agree with this.
Yes.
My Ivy League clients are the ones who are more skeptical. They're the ones who are willing to pay. They're the ones who are actually ready. And I just closed a loan, well, it was a few months ago, for an individual who graduated from MIT.
Sure.
Okay. I graduated from San Diego State. And I graduated from San Diego State when it was the party school. It's a good school now.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have been allowed into the school now.
Sure.
He treated me like I graduated from MIT in regard to my knowledge of the SBA lending program. He gave me that respect. He asked me questions. He listened to me. And then sometimes I'll find that those who are really new to the space, they're trying to tell me, just like you said, they'll tell you this, 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 and this about the business. And you're saying, wait a minute, I'm the expert here. Do you find that those individuals, and the reason I'm pointing this out is because you and I are going to go back to our businesses. We're going to work with individuals. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that the individuals I'm working with and that you're working with will watch this. And maybe not directly, but indirectly, they'll be able to hear our conversation. Do you also find that those who maybe have more education, who would be considered more experienced in ETA, they give you that deference, they give you that respect, and they listen to you more than those who maybe come from more humble means, I would say, and less experience trying to tell you because they're emotionally involved? Have you experienced that as well?
So, yes, and I'm going to break it down just one click further. I think the private equity, Ivy League, been on Wall Street investment bankers respect the lender, the service provider, the lawyer, because they've been trained to think about who's the expert in any given situation, who's seen the most reps, and listen to who has seen the most reps.
Right? I like the way you put that, who's seen the most reps. I like that.
And so that happens, but where I think the Ivy League fancy pants folks fail is they do not connect with the average seller or broker. And so that's where they get bamboozled and messed up. Mm-hmm. And so they're really good with the service providers and the lenders, the more white collar folks.
Yeah.
But they have trouble with the blue collar folks, right?
Got it. Okay.
And so then my more blue collar clients, they get along with the broker and the seller just fine. They're able to call BS better. They communicate at the level of their person way better. Mm-hmm. But sometimes their lack of experience with identifying who in an ecosystem is the smartest or least smart, depending on who's seen most reps, mm-hmm. they don't do well with the service providers. Mm-hmm. So I see that that sort of dichotomy again and again.
Got it. Yeah, I really appreciate you breaking that down and even adding a fuller answer there. What I want to do now is talk to me about your parents. You said that your parents have a unique connection to the world of SBA financing. I'd like to hear about that.
So both my parents worked with the SBA when the SBA was a direct lender, and they worked in Detroit doing that in the 80s. Mm. And when I say a direct lender today, the SBA guarantees a loan at Bank of America, at Live Oak, at where Ryan works, okay? And so they are a guarantor of a local bank's decision. In the 80s, the government was actually lending money directly through the SBA 8A program.
Wow.
And so both my parents worked in that. In fact, this is the Holland Consulting business card holder from my mom, who worked for my dad at that point. And then my dad's SBA binder is on the bookshelf over there. And so I kind of got this honestly, because this is, I'm like a second generation, I guess, advisor in this. And the difference with the SBA being a direct lender is a lot of the first minority business owners in Detroit were able to leverage the SBA, the government lending program, mm-hmm. to level the playing field where a lot of the local banks might not been a play, might not have played fair, right?
Understood.
And so a huge piece of my upbringing was that helping the everyday person reach their sort of maximum potential goal, leveraging this SBA program. And so it's very nice to be able to connect, you know, me to my parents in that way.
That's great. Yeah. And I'm sure that's why you do have that connection and obviously that passion, but also that sincerity when you serve your clients. Elliot, if I'm a searcher, I found a business, that listing broker looks me in the eye with that twinkle in their eye and say, I'm here for you. But there's something in the back of your mind saying, I don't really know. How did they find you? Where can they find you? And how is the best way to get in touch with you?
The easiest way is Google Elliot Holland or Guardian Due Diligence. And even if you misspell it and get close, my SEO will have my listing very high on Google. So you'll find me that way. We have a resource library on the website with over 150 free resources. That's free downloads, that's videos, that's how-to guides, that's blog articles. So start there, because I talk about a lot of that stuff and you can search it by anything you need. And then my number one social is Twitter. I am the king of QOE on Twitter.
That's right.
And if you follow my Twitter channel, you can get sort of those 140, 340 character tidbits, but they'll all lead you on like a crumb trail,
yep.
to the truth. And so either way, and then my DMs are easy to get into on Twitter. And then my contact information is at the bottom of my website. If you have a letter of intent, we do free LOI reviews. So you can go to offerfromelliot.com, mm-hmm. and I'll review your letter of intent for free.
Okay.
And those are the best ways to get in contact with me. And I'd love to hear from you.
Wow, that's great. And then just for my audience, I like to tell them one of the ways that you know you're working with a true service provider who's been in the business for a long time is that they provide you with resources. X is an open playing field. Anybody could get on X tomorrow, tell you that they are the king of QOE. And when you go to their website, it's crickets. And so one of the ways you know that Elliot is the real deal, not only do people sing your praises who have worked with you, who have been your clients, but also when they go to your website, you're going to have a treasure trove of resources for them to learn from. So, Elliot, I just want to say thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate your time. I know this is going to be valuable for my audience and even those beyond. And I wish you all the best and have a great rest of your day.
I'm so glad to be here, Ryan. Thanks for having me. And I hope you guys learned something. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the My SBA Loan Pro podcast. Be sure to like, share, subscribe, and leave a review. But most importantly, we hope you'll use this information to start your SBA loan journey today by texting or calling us at 858-762-2774 or completing our online application at mysba.pro/app. That's mysba.pro/app. We look forward to working with you.